So as we kind of start tonight, I have a question for us, and that is, do you think religion is generally growing in popularity and practice, or do you think generally decreasing? Now, maybe that might sound like an easy question to answer, because I think the majority of us would probably say that in general, religion is on the decline. Churches sit empty across the country, congregations are shrinking. Religion seems to be on the decline. In the 1950s, a sociologist by the name of Peter Berger, he argued that basically, as the modern era progresses, we will become, as a culture and society, more and more secular. With enough education, with enough knowledge, with enough scientific advancement, religion will just sort of get pushed to the periphery and it will slowly die out. With the rise of the internet, new ideas, new philosophies, scientific data, it's just shared more easily and quickly. And in time, he argued that the world will become more and more similar and more secular. The world will come to the same generic conclusion. This is all that there is, naturalism. And religion is going to be wiped away. Now, at face value, his sort of thesis seems somewhat believable, doesn't it? As evangelical Christians in this country, we might feel discouraged about what we see in the world around us. People seem to be abandoning religion. But if you go into Waterstones, while you're in town doing your shopping, have a look at the religion and the spirituality section. You'll notice that it's not sort of a small two rows of books. You'll see two full entire bookshelves devoted to religion and spirituality. That section in our Waterstones has doubled since I have come to Barry just within 2 years. Now, why would that be if religion is slowly dying? The existence of these bookshelves point to the fact that as a society, we're actually currently experiencing a large resurgence of religion and spirituality. Attitudes towards God aren't really as pessimistic as we would have thought. You see, that sociologist, Peter Berger, about 40 years later, in the year 2000, he wrote another book, which basically said, I was wrong. And that book is called The Desecularization of Religion and World Politics. And he argues that basically, the modern era as we know it doesn't naturally lead to secularism, but it leads to what he calls pluralism. You see, humanity, we are not, as a giant society, arriving at one generic conclusion that there is no such thing as a supernatural. Rather, as the modern age progresses, we just have more and more options and varieties of different religions and spiritualities. On a global scale, Christianity is still growing at a very quick rate, along with other major religions. And here in Western Europe, we see a decline in maybe institutional religion, but we are just as religious in this country. The reason we have more bookshelves in Waterstones on religion and spirituality at Waterstones is to accommodate for this growing variety and plurality of different spiritualities. In even secular Europe, there is an increase even in kind of folk belief. Let me give you an example. A majority of Icelanders claim to actually believe and hidden creatures that are somewhat similar to elves. Majority of Icelanders. About a third of all Austrians actually believe in lucky charms. Not the cereal, but actual lucky charms. Half of Sweden believes in mental telepathy. According to different categories, it seems that people my age in the U.S. are obsessed right now with astrology. As Berger's recognized, we're not becoming more atheistic. We're just as concerned about questions of our existence, of meaning, of God. We just find that there's more and more perspectives as the days go on. And so we live in an age of confusion in our world today. For the modern person, there aren't really any more points of reference for us. So at this moment, the question for us, as Westgate Chapel, is there anything about our faith, our understanding of truth, our beliefs, is there anything that stands out in this ocean of perspectives? As we sit here, do we have something we can offer the world imploding with confusion? Is there a light that can guide the way, or will we be forever lost in a multitude of different ways? Well, as we're going to see in our text, what makes Christianity distinct, what makes us stand out, isn't that we just put our hope and trust in another belief system. If that were the case, then Christianity would just be one option among many options. But what makes Christianity stand out is that we place our hope and trust in a person. The message of the gospel is, come and meet a person. Every other religion, every other spirituality points to some sort of morality or abstract belief system, cultural values, but Christianity says, come, meet a person. So tonight as we look at John 8, there might be some of you here who are seriously trying to search for some firm footing for your life, something to stand on, something trustworthy. You might be asking, why Christianity? Why Jesus? Others of us might come who have already put our trust in Jesus. Tonight, though, it's my hope that we come to know him better, because that is the entire Christian life. We have a tendency to talk about Christianity as some beliefs that are outside of us, but we can be reminded that the good news that we offer the world is a person to introduce them to. Not a religion, but a personal reality to experience. So we're going to keep those Bibles open in John 8. We're going to look at Jesus' claim to be the light of the world. And we're going to look at it in three parts. We're going to look at these three areas: the incredible depth of the claim, the absurdity of that claim, and then the promise of the claim. So first, the depth of that claim that Jesus is the light of the world. We're going to begin by actually looking at the very first verse of this section and the last verse. So we're going to read verse 12 again and then verse 20. So, in verse 12, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And then jump down to 20. And he spoke these words while teaching in the temple courts near the place where the offerings were put. Yet no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. No one seized him. Jesus claims to be the light of the world, and no one seizes him. The word there for seize has many different translations. Other translations put, and no one arrested him. And another translation, and no one killed him. No one killed him. Now, why would John want us to know that no one seized him? It's because John knows something that we don't know. Being the light of the world might sound to sort of our ears as maybe a nice, harmless cliche to say, I'm the light of the world. But for the Jewish people, this was an extremely loaded term. Hearing that claim as 21st century people is like, it's kind of like someone coming over on Christmas Day without any understanding what Christmas is about. Let me explain. Let's say you had a friend who lived in some remote part of the world and had never heard anything about Christmas. And let's say you bought that friend a plane ticket to come over on December 25th. They got off the plane, they came into your house, they saw your freshly cut Christmas tree with all your weird family ornaments, the meal you've been working on all day, the presents under the tree, a man dressed in a red pajamas that's far too happy for his own good, and they heard the sound of Christmas carols. What would they think that was about? It's just bizarre, a weird, cliched, silly party. But they wouldn't understand the richness, significance, the complexity, the tradition, the months of waiting. Well, it's in the same way I think this claim, I am the light of the world, appears to us as maybe thin, but really it's deep and it's rich, the same way Christmas morning is deep and rich with awe and wonder. So basically, John is saying that if we understand what Jesus is claiming, we would be amazed that no one got up and seized him, choked him, strangled him, or killed him. I am the light of the world is a severe claim. So, to understand what makes that claim so profound and deep, we need to understand when and where Jesus makes this claim. So, at the beginning of verse 12, we read, when Jesus spoke again to the people. When Jesus spoke again. Now, John writes that to kind of connect what is happening here with what has been going on. This is one episode that that Jesus is still a part of. And it started in chapter 7. And in chapter 7, verse 37, we see that it is the last and greatest day of the festival. And that festival is the Feast of Tabernacles. Chapter 7, verse 37. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles was a 7-day long celebration. And it kind of commemorated how God brought his people out of the Exodus, out of Egypt, and sent them towards a promised land. But in between the promised land and the time in slavery in Egypt, there was this period in between we call the wilderness period. And the Feast of Tabernacles was all about commemorating how Israel was forced to depend on God for water and shelter and food and guidance. So Israel in the wilderness would camp out in these little booths as they made their way towards the promised land. And they ate manna that came down from heaven. The Lord provided water from a rock. And then the Lord guided them through the wilderness by a pillar of smoke in the day, pillar of fire by night. This is why the Feast of Tabernacles is also called the Feast of Booths, because people actually built these small little huts during the festival to commemorate that wilderness time. There was even a sort of a water pouring event to remember how God provided water from the rock. And then there were these huge candelabras they would light up to remind them that actually God had led them through the wilderness. Now, if you're really sharp, you might be starting to make connection between Israel's time in the wilderness, with the festival, and with Jesus. We haven't read it, but in John 6, Jesus comes and says, "I am the bread of life. I'm the bread that comes down from heaven. Do you remember that manna? Well, I am the true bread." In John 7, Jesus says, "Come to me, those who are thirsty, and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture said, rivers of living water will flow out of them." And here in John 8, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Do you remember being led through the wilderness by a pillar of fire? I am that light. That is a huge claim. In the Old Testament, the pillar of fire was understood as a sort of the glory light of God's immediate presence. When the pillar of fire would come and hover over the tabernacle, Israel was assured that God was present. But when the pillar of fire would move, they'd pack up and follow the pillar of fire. All of that is in the context as Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," on the last day of the Festival of Tabernacles. So let's now jump back into the festival. Because every night during the festival, they would light these huge candelabras in the temple courts that not only lit up the whole temple, but that light would then flood out over all of the surrounding Jerusalem. And they lit these candelabras every night, except for the last night, which is when this event happens, when Jesus says these words. We pick up the story as they would have been sort of cleaning up all the decorations and putting everything away. The last night of the feast is always the worst night, isn't it? It's the end. It feels terrible to take down the Christmas tree, to take down the lights, haul all the decorations up into the attic. The party's over. But it's far worse for these people, because in that temple, in that court, in front of those huge, cold, dark lamps, it was impossible to not realize that the glory light of God's presence had not been seen in that temple for centuries. On that last night of the feast, when the lights went out and the party was over, there was this overwhelming sense of despair. And we're told that on this night that something happened. Jesus stands up, presumably next to one of these giant, cold, dark lamps, and he claims, "Don't you realize I am the light of the world? I am that glory light." Jesus tells us, "The thing you've longed for so much has come. In fact, the thing you longed for, the pillar of fire, that was just provisional. It was imperfect. It was partial. But I am," Jesus says, "I am the very glory of God. I'm not like the prophets of old who merely pointed to the light and reflected the light. They were just moons. I am the sun. I'm the radiance. I am God come to you." To recognize Jesus as the light of the world is to recognize him as the very glory and presence of God. The depth of the claim is to recognize Jesus is to see the light. To recognize Jesus is to see the light. This isn't some abstract, philosophical, fluffy claim. Jesus is connecting himself with Israel's entire history. This claim is one of the most explicit times that Jesus simply says, I am God. I'm not just a little light to lead Israel to the promised land either, but I'm the light of the entire world to lead all men from darkness into the true promised land. As one New Testament writer puts it, in the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times in various ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, and the Son is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of his being. In other words, Christmas had come. We see the depth of this claim. To recognize Jesus is to see light itself. That glorious light that all other religions tries to fit into cognitive boxes, the light which this new spirituality is trying to seek and seek after, is found only in the person of Jesus. A person, not an idea, not a story, a concept, but a person is the illuminating aspect for Christianity. It is the illuminating aspect for your life and for mine. But notice, not everyone recognizes Jesus as the light. A lot of people refuse to accept Jesus' claim, which is absurd. So would you read verse 13 with me? Verse 13, the Pharisees challenged him. Here you are, appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid. Your testimony is not valid. Wait, what? What are they talking about? Jesus just made this huge, earth-shattering, reality-defining claim. We read, so the Pharisees challenged him. Why? Because Jesus' claim is self-protesting, it's circular. Aren't they missing the whole point, though? It seems as if Jesus makes this giant claim, and then the Pharisees want to take it on a detour. And as we'll see, Jesus is happy to follow them on this detour because it actually proves his point. The conversation is going to move towards his authority and his relationship to the Father. He's going to show us that actually he's the light of the world precisely because of his relationship to the Father. However absurd it might sound, Jesus' point is that to know the Son is to know the Father. Let's read that verse one more time, verse 13. They challenged him. Here you are, appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid. Now, what's going on here is they're actually referring back to something Jesus said earlier in chapter 5, verse 31. And way back in chapter 5, Jesus said, if I alone bear witness about myself, then my testimony is not true. So Jesus said that, if I alone bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true. And here, as the Pharisees hear Jesus' audacious claim, I'm the light of the world, they claim, ah, I got him, gotcha. You said that if you bear witness about yourself, it's not true. While you're doing it, you must be wrong. You have no authority. Now, this is a somewhat of a hard kind of concept to try and get our minds around. And if some of you are lost, that is okay. I want to try and do a quick demonstration of what is actually going on between the Pharisees and Jesus. Now, for the next part, I need your help on this point. I'm going to ask you some questions that a 7-year-old could answer, and I assume that you'll be able to do it. I'm just going to put a photo up, and I'm just going to ask you, what is it? And I need your participation. So whoever knows what the image is first, just say it out loud, and we'll move on. So shouldn't be that hard. Let's see what the first image is of. Anyone know what that is? Scone or scone? What? Someone said the right answer. It is not scone. It is not scone. It's a biscuit. Let's get this right. Okay. You're getting it. Let's move on. What is this? Anyone? A boot? Wrong. It's a trunk. Come on. We don't say boot. That's what you wear on your feet. Where do you get all your prescriptions? What would you call that? Okay, you're all turning into Americans. We would call that a drugstore. I would never call that a chemist, but I know how bizarre that of a word that sounds. Anybody know what these are? Crisps. That's right, some people are getting it. They're chips. Last and final one. I do like your chips as well, but last one. What is this? Torch. Getting lots of different things. Most of you, I would assume, would call that a torch. I would never call that a torch. I don't use the word torch in my normal vocabulary, but you use the word torch, but I don't use that word in the same way I don't use boot to refer to a trunk or chemist to refer to a drugstore, but I don't really use the word torch. All right. Now, let's say for some odd reason, you were stuck in a cave. I don't know what you were doing in the cave, but you were stuck in the cave without food, without water, in darkness, for days wandering around. Maybe you're just hours away from dying. What if I personally came and I found you in that cave and I had one of these in my hands? One of these. And I said, here, I have a torch. I can lead you out. You don't have to die. Take the torch. Let's go. And what if you said, ha, got you. You said you don't use the word torch. You're a liar. You said you don't use it. No, but this actually is a torch. That's what I'd say. This is kind of what's going on with the Pharisees. They get so hung up on the words that they don't realize what's in front of them. Here's the torch. You can be led to life. I am the light of the world. Ah, but you said you wouldn't say that. They're refusing to see the light that is right in front of them. This is absurd. Think about that picture, how absurd that would be. Everything they've been waiting for centuries, everything they had been waiting in hopeful expectancy standing right in front of them, they can't even see it. They get hung up on semantics and word games. And Jesus says even more in verse 18 and 19. Verse 18, I am one who testifies for myself. My other witness is the Father who sent me. Then they asked him, where is your Father? You do not know me or my Father. And Jesus replied, if you knew me, you would know my Father also. He's saying, don't you realize I am the glory of the one you claim to know? The absurdity is to know the Son is to know the Father. The Son of God is standing in front of them offering life. Or in other words, it's Christmas morning and they're still fast asleep. The question for us is, are we sleeping as well? Or maybe we've potentially gotten bored with our Christian walk. Maybe we need to hear the absurdity of Jesus' claim this evening. This is a huge, ridiculous, but magnificent claim. I am the light of the world. Can you hear how all-encompassing that claim is? I am the light of the world. But for those who are willing to hear and accept the absurdity of this claim, that Jesus is God, that he is the only true light, there's a deep and profound promise. Back to verse 12. And he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Now that's an interesting way of phrasing it, isn't it? The promise for those who realize the depth and the absurdity of this claim is that they will have the light. When Jesus says, I'm the light of the world, he promises that to follow the light is to have the light. To follow the light is to have the light. If you follow the light, you will not walk in darkness, but you will have the light. And here we have the key of Christianity. And I don't know if there's any grammar nerds out there, but the key of Christianity is found in grammar. It's found in the concept of personal pronouns. Let me show you. It's not just that Jesus, the person, is God. That is not what saves you. It's not that you accept that he is the light of the world. Christianity is not some sort of mental assent to some facts. It's that Jesus wants to be your light. The person of Jesus wants to be your God. This is the entire storyline of the Old Testament. You will be my people, and I will be your God. And Jesus comes to fulfill that promise. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He is not just the light, he is your light. Jesus is saying, don't you realize, I am God and I want to be yours. If you follow this light, you will have it. Jesus isn't like other religious figures who merely give teachings about God or point to God. He is the very substance of the light. He refuses to be lost in the sort of the haze of spirituality we find in our world today. He will not be content as another option among the plurality of other religious options. And he wants to be your light. If Jesus is your light, then he will color all of your life. No longer will your life be a haze that you wander through. If Jesus is your light, your life will have a whole new dimension attached to it. For Jesus will be the light by which you see every single other thing in this world. He will reveal all that is beautiful. He'll be the light in which you see God, the light in which you see the whole history of redemption. He'll be the light in which you see hills and valleys and oceans and mountains and animals and people. Everything looks different with the light of Christ, even tragedy and pain and death. And until his light fills the whole earth, it will help us to bear the sorrow of darkness we see all around us. And you and I can bring the true, deep, real light into this world, and everything can change. His light will be a lamp on your trembling path. It'll be the presence in the midst of loneliness. It'll be a warm and soft glow in the midst of pain. Everything changes when you have this light, because you know who you're with and you know where you're going. Jesus doesn't want to play word games with us or confuse us anymore. He could not be any more clearer. The waiting, the hoping, the expectancy of all of history culminates in Jesus come to us, the great Christmas morning. John writes these words in the first chapter of his gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, and in him was life. The life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. I don't know where you might be. Maybe you are feeling like you're swimming in the ocean of 21st century pluralism. It's just difficult to find your way in everyday life. Maybe you want somewhere to find a firm footing, an anchor, something to hold on to. Jesus comes and he asks you, let go of everything else, promising you that life and light. Acknowledge that you walk in darkness confused and turn and follow the light. Christianity is not about mental acrobatics. It's about trusting a living, breathing man who happens to be God. He wants to give you his life and life. Do you see it? Now, for those of us who have been following this light for years, have you potentially grown weary and tired wandering through this wilderness? Have you become discouraged by the world around us? Please don't forget that this light is leading us to a promised land. It starts with a pillar of fire leading a people out of slavery to a promised land. But now, the entire world is led through the wilderness of darkness, depending on God for our light, our daily bread, until we reach the promised land. The Bible ends, and in the last chapter it says, "And I saw the city. It had no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives its light, and its lamp is the Lamb. And by its light the nations will walk, the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and its gates will never be shut by day, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light." And Jesus said, "These words are trustworthy and true. Behold, I am coming soon." So, Westgate, be encouraged that despite this confused world we live in, you have a light. You have the light of life. So step ahead in whatever the Lord is calling you to do as a church, as individuals, with boldness and courage. We do not believe we have just another viable option for living. We believe we know life itself.